Meditieren, Yoga, Joggen, nichts entspannt mich.
Echt? Mich entspannt meine Steuer total.
Steuer? Wie Finanzamt? Die Steuererklärung?
Ja, ich habe ganz locker über 1000 Euro zurückbekommen.
Hast du geheime Connections oder Excel-Superkräfte?
Nö, nur die Wieso-Steuer-App.
Wow, und das ist einfach?
Klar, die macht fast alles automatisch.
Ich fühle mich plötzlich so entspannt.
Hol dir dein Geld zurück. Abgabefrist 31. Juli.
Was?
Schaffst du ganz entspannt mit Wieso-Steuer.
Ach, ja.
Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 34, Episode 12. Coming up on this show, we've got the Hutt Stalkers, the curse of the White Lady, and the return of the old gods. I'm your host, Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
The curse of the White Lady, is that in reference to the Cathars leader we were talking about recently?
Yes.
You've had enough?
Yes. This book I'm sick of talking about.
Well, that has
cursed us.
Partially our own fault because our audio equipment suddenly just stopped working properly and we recorded an entire show without realizing that there were silences inserted.
Yeah, so, not our fault. It's the curse of the goddess.
Because was it the joke I made about running her over on the highway?
I forgot about that. I forgot, like, the last 10 minutes of that show that we lost was just all these scenarios of us, like, running her over and chopping her up into little bits and then disposing of the body and getting away with it.
Yeah.
And then years later, past the statute of limitations, you were doing podcasts about that crime. I forgot about that. So
all of a sudden, that episode is destroyed.
Aaron and I, we record a show on Tuesday and over the last couple of episodes, we've been talking about this Otto Rahn Grail Hunter story from Richard Stanley. Great book, great story. And we were focusing on Richard Stanley's...
Richard's experiences. Yeah.
And what made the story interesting. And when he got to the end of his adventures following after Otto Rahn, this German medievalist, occult-searching Nazi, he had this experience of encountering the goddess himself, encountering the White Lady, who was meant to be this... sort of reincarnation of a 13th century semi-divine leader of the Cathars, right? And so we mentioned this on two shows. So the first show was last week in the Plus extension. That show was corrupted. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that. There was something wrong with one of the feeds.
Yeah, so after...
That's a weird coincidence.
The local file was fine, but... So you play it on your machine, it's fine. When we uploaded it, it became corrupted after upload. And so the last 20 minutes of that show were gone. It was completely cut off. I had to re-upload the file. It worked on the re-upload.
Yep.
So if you missed the end of last week's show, you'll have to delete it and download it again.
But then
on Tuesday, we completed the story. Aaron and I sat down for a full 90 minutes discussing Otto Rahn, discussing Richard Stanley's encounter with this white lady, this goddess in the ruins of the castle.
But we did make parallels also to, you know, being misled by certain entities, and we questioned what had happened with her and people that had followed her, and clearly she struck us down with a curse.
Yeah, because when I got home really late at night, there was a massive car accident on the highway, by the way.
Yeah, I just missed that.
Which you just missed.
I just missed it, yeah.
And I get a call from our audio editor and he points out that there's silence that's been inserted every 30 seconds in the show. So we lost the entire episode. And after that weekend, I just realized this whole topic is cursed. Like, the White Lady's out to get us.
So why do you bring it back on another show?
Well, the only thing to do is double down.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're right.
You got to double down.
Yeah.
So this white lady that Richard Stanley encountered, it was said that she was the living spirit, remember, that was going to bring back the force of the Cathars, the
yes.
Gnosticism, Rosicrucianism, maybe even you could say, what's the word? The
anarchism?
Freemasonry, that kind of spiritual force.
But she was all... Not necessarily her, but wasn't, you know, part of the thrust of this belief system was also to tear down, like, conventional or traditional systems.
Yeah, to attack the corrupt evil church and bring back the old pagan beliefs. And this just wasn't his own sighting. And here's the sketch.
That's right. He encountered this,
of
apparently.
Of what Richard Stanley saw. So this woman appeared to him in the ruins of this castle on top of that mountain in France, in the Pyrenees.
Like she was made of moonlight, yeah, the way it was described.
He said she was glowing white, but she still had a force. She was crunching the stones underneath her feet.
That's right. Very physical.
And his companion, I think it was maybe his girlfriend at the time, was with him and actually saw her as well.
Mm.
She made a hand signal to Richard and gave him some kind of vision, a spiritual vision. He claimed he was overwhelmed with bliss and emotion and ecstasy. He saw the future and past of humankind. And the experience was so life-changing that...
He literally changed his life.
He left the UK. He moved to this mountain. Remember at the end, we described how he had now dedicated his life, his soul and his sword to the goddess.
But doesn't he just run tours for boomers now?
Sorry?
Doesn't he just run tours for boomers now?
Well, boomers and other people that want to follow this Cathar Gnostic Rosicrucian belief system, and they have, you know, their little ceremonies on the mountain and they have their own memorials and statues and things to go to. And so I thought it was just bizarre that every time we've tried to talk about this entity, something goes wrong.
To be fair, it's not often that I'll drive home after a show and go, maybe I went a bit too far on that.
Maybe I was a bit harsh towards the goddess.
It's not often. I was like, and then of course, you know, it gets deleted basically. So it's like, oh, that worked out nicely.
And it was exactly what I thought had happened technically as well. And I mentioned it on the last show because I ended up having to do the show myself.
Which you didn't tell me.
And I couldn't do it to you. I couldn't sit you down.
I do appreciate that.
Tell it to you all over again. But this sighting of the lady, this white lady, and remember that's what he calls it in his book, The Return of the White Lady.
Mm.
This white lady has been appearing quite a lot lately, noticeably in Chris Bledsoe's experiences from UFO of God. I've got a video here of him explaining exactly how that old order is finished and there's a new beginning. Let's take a listen.
She said that there was a shift in the powers of the heavens and that she had been away. The feminine energy was about to come back and there wasn't no stopping it, and that there would be a shift, and that shift would be into Aquarius, and that the divine feminine would come back as the energy that would create 1,000 years of peace. That's what she told me. There'd be trouble first, but in time that peace would come to this world.
Oh, please.
It's all about peace. The it's new always, that's energy's what I mean. Coming like, through. Yeah.
It's always this promise. There's like a promise of some type of change and a positive change, and it's going to bring about peace. But as long as we destroy, you know, the current setup or whatever it is.
Yeah, tear everything down.
Tear everything down.
Attack the old order, yeah. Destroy the patriarchy, destroy yeah. The church, reject everything orthodox. And he's even put a date on this event. It's April 2026. Let's take a listen.
The lady explained to me that in April of 26, there would be an alignment where this star, which is a blue star, of Regulus, appears on the horizon in front of the Sphinx, and it would be red.
And you know what? This is right.
That's what she said.
I've actually spoken to astronomers. This is the phenomenal thing about this.
Yeah, and she said it'll be red. And when that happens, it would mark a shift into a new knowledge, not an apocalypse. That's what she told me. It doesn't mean Jesus is coming back. There's a new knowledge that's coming. What is that? Is it under the pyramids they've discovered something? Is it the Hall of Records? Is it disclosure?
You know what's funny?
That he sounds like Ozzy Osbourne?
No. That, like, I remember when we started this, right? And I'm going to reminisce a little bit. But when we started, right, we would, you know, regularly kind of jump between ragging on but also being intrigued by Project Camelot, for example, right? And most of the time, Project Camelot did have more, like, lunatics on and, like, making some really outrageous claims. But that was, like, it was readily recognized by the general kind of populace that that's what it was. Like, you knew that you're going to get someone who's a little bit unhinged. You were going to get someone who's a bit wild and crazy. How
it's
does,
like a circus.
And look, I don't know that journalist personally, but I've been watching him for years on
Coulthard.
Coulthard on Australian television. How does he sit there in basically what is the equivalent of a Project Camelot interview? And it's like, you just go, oh, this is wonderful. Yes, okay, let's just accept that this is going to happen. It's like, it's surreal to me.
It's funny that you bring up Coulthard because he's connected in all of this.
What?
It's like he's the ringleader of this circus because one of the other big eyewitnesses who claims to have encountered the lady, the white lady, the goddess, is Jake Barber.
Oh, yes.
Remember old crazy eyes Jake Barber? There he is. Got to zoom in on those puppies. This totally normal looking guy.
I told you, it's a demon trying to escape. I'm not saying he's possessed by demons, but like in general.
Here he is talking about his experiences with the lady. Let's take a listen.
As I came over this object, it was this overwhelming sense of emotion. I feel a sense of my mother, this intense hybrid of sadness and happiness and beauty. I felt like something connected with me. And it was so overwhelming that I began to cry. I felt like something was inside of me. I felt like I was possessed by the most beautiful spirit. It was loving, but there was a sense of sadness at the same time. Felt like the spirit of God, but not in any masculine sense that I had ever felt. It was like, again, the feeling of my mother, my daughter, and beauty.
There genuinely are people who can actually make a mental, spiritual connection to a technology.
Yes. If you want to connect with it, if you want to have a relationship, and if you want to see stuff flying in the sky, you need to be channeling a loving energy. What is real is the ability to go into something like a meditative state and summon UAP and pilot UAP. Gay men and kids and females are more often seen as having the predisposition for the psionic ability.
Oh, for fuck's sake. You know, I'm just...
He's had enough.
Okay, you know what? No, I am. I'm going to have a rant. Right? I don't care. Like, we're finishing Mysterious Universe at this form at the end of the year. I don't care, right? I had someone like, this is how like retarded people have become. I saw someone in the YouTube comments, before they even listened to the show, start ranting and raving about how homophobic we are because of a joke about left-handed homosexuals summoning psionics or summoning UFOs.
They don't understand about the psionics.
Didn't even bother take a second to listen, just immediately judged because of a comment and was like, but he directly says it. He's the one claiming it. But why? Why do gay men and women and kids seem to be better at summoning UFOs?
AKA demons. Well, that's why I wanted to play that, because what he's describing and what he's going through, how he breaks down in tears, that's exactly what Richard Stanley described, this spiritual revelation, this moment of being overcome by this ecstatic feeling of love from this entity.
But that's what a very low-level entity could do with nefarious intentions for you. You think that just simply because you feel something, that your emotions are activated, that's some divine... If it was a divine energy... Look, I'm not religious in any sense, but if it was a divine energy, it wouldn't have any sadness attached to it. It would be so overpowering to it, just you and your fallible human frame, that... It's like you wouldn't even be able to describe it.
Well, there's some really intriguing connections between these guys. They all claim these encounters with the lady. They all have similar visceral spiritual experiences from this lady, this white lady, this goddess. And they all claim the same thing is happening. They all claim there is a return to the old pagan ways. They say there's a new beginning just around the corner. Even Bledsoe gives a date on it. They constantly talk about this new coming of knowledge. And in fact, at the end of Richard Stanley's book, he calls for this reattunement to Mother Earth. He says, we need to return to the Earth's subtle rhythms, to the old ways of the hill and the stream, while simultaneously demanding a new technology, an implosive technology that transcends explosive nuclear energy, a hardware that embraces the power of quarks and quasars and quantum universes. But you notice the similarities? This is a guy who is not connected with the UFO world at all, who is doing medieval research, climbing the hills of this old ruins of a castle, encounters this lady, and he's talking about pairing this new spirituality
with a technology.
With technology.
Which is what was just described previously by, what's his name?
Barber,
yeah, Barber. I was about to say Grush, not Grush.
Well, it's exactly what these UFO guys are trying to do, and what they're claiming we can do is summon down these craft with these entities and bring a new beginning to humankind through technology and through a new religious vision.
Well, this is something that I was saying on that episode that was lost, and I'll stand by it, is that what we're hearing is no different to what happened with the contactees. The contactees were told that there is a new technology and that we must, you know, steer away from nuclear weapons and we must save the Earth. It's the same kind of thing, right? That the problem is now, I feel like it's always been this force trying to mislead humanity. Yes, of course, nuclear weapons are dangerous. Yes, of course, we have to look after our environment. Like that's all very valid and very important. But there's this sinister feeling about this. Like it's not like it's done for the benefit of humanity. It's like, is it being done to preserve the planet for them if they're coming back or if they're going to invade? I don't know exactly what it is, but I equated this kind of stuff to what we have these days, right? What he's talking about at the end of the book there with developing some technology and returning to the ways of the Earth and to bonding with nature and all this kind of stuff is that to do that, it's basically what we hear the conspiracies of the elite are trying to do, even the WEF, right? You basically have to wipe out 90% of humanity. You have this new wonderful technology that comes in, perhaps AI, that deals with the 90%, like what has to be done. Automation handles all that. And guess what happens? All of a sudden, Earth has got no populace and they just get to live in their heaven on Earth.
I love how intuitive you are about this stuff, because I know that you haven't done the reading I've done today, but you just totally nailed it.
Did I really?
Because this stream of this spiritual force that's connected to Gnosticism, connected to Rosicrucianism, that Richard Stanley is trying to reawaken in the world, there's a lot of people who believe that the Georgia Guidestones were created by Rosicrucians.
I wouldn't be surprised.
It's a Rosicrucian ideology to see this reduction in population. So you just hit the nail on the head. All these forms of thinking, all these ideologies are connected. It's all linked.
And what better way to show someone a hugely spiritual experience that fills them with love and wonder, where they start spreading the word that no, this is the right thing to do, but it's innately anti-human.
And yet when we try and expose it, when we tried to do a serious investigation into it, our show got killed.
It's a bit weird, because I think that it's not...
Not only once, it happened twice. Yeah. The first time we talked about it, the MP3 was corrupted. We try and talk about it again for an hour and a half. The whole show is lost.
I wonder what will happen here.
Should I check the recording?
Yeah, just double check the recording. I'm sure it's okay.
So I'm going to be talking about that. I think I've uncovered a fair bit about the true nature of this white lady that Richard Stanley and others claim they've encountered. I'm going to be going into some work from a...
Well, we're already in it. Just get in.
Well, I just want to give you the opportunity
you
to talk about what you've got coming
talk
up.
Talk about Plus at the end of the show.
What have you got coming up?
Well, we're going to be heading over to Africa. We're going to be following around these little strange craft that have been flying around over there. It's funny how, like I've been talking about, the way that people interpret events, it's all the same kind of stuff. But when you reference it to places like Africa, where... You know, they have culturally different ways of, you know, talking about these kind of things. Superstition is heavily ingrained when it comes to ufological encounters. So we're going to be talking about how superstitions in Africa coincide with many of the more modern reports we have. Like, yeah, people getting blasted by rays of light from the sky, and how, no, it's probably not a good idea to summon in a UFO, no matter what circumstance.
This weird flying man.
Oh, yes. The Ponte Mensola case. Oh, yes. And they all get, there's a lot of blasting going on.
This looks cool. Okay. So that's coming up in Plus. All right. Yeah, so to get to the bottom of this white lady stuff, I had to go to an author. This is funny because this is an author. I often see his books and I think, yeah, that's suitably schizo for the show. Like,
that's suitably insane.
Jonathan Kahn, I should say. He's got a new book out called The Avatar, The Return of the Ancients and the Future of America. So if you look at this guy's books on Amazon, it's all this kind of... Christian prophecy stuff that I guess sells really well, like the dragon's prophecy, Israel and the resurrection and the end of days, the harbinger. And he just pumps these out. And I always see them and think, oh, this will be like a fun conspiracy romp. But it's like 10% interesting conspiracy, 90% just riffing on Bible quotes.
Right,
just like riffing on. But I decided to give it a shot because I think in this Avatar book, I think he actually understands quite well what's going on with this white lady phenomenon. And he goes as far as naming what he believes is behind it. So Jonathan Kahn, he's a messianic Jewish rabbi pastor.
Okay.
Apparently that's a thing. And he talks about this book, he talks about The Return of the Ancients in the first kind of quarter of this book. He asks, is it possible that behind the central movements and issues of our time are entities of ancient origin with consciousness and volition? Could they be the unseen agents behind the transformation of our culture, indwelling movements, institutions, agendas, and even the people of our times?
Yes.
And I thought, this is something that we spoke about on the show that we lost. We made the point that in the 13th century, you had the Catholic Church going up against Catharism and this opposing Gnostic train of thought. And, you know, of course, we have our ideological conflicts in the modern day. And I made the point that behind these things are greater forces. And what
non-human forces.
Exactly. What we see on in the human world is like a stage, but there's greater forces at play, spiritual forces behind the scenes. And he's already written about this in a book called The Return of the Gods. So he talks about the gods and goddesses of the old world.
So you mean like the Greek and Roman gods? Or even further back?
Yes, but, you know, Mesopotamia, even Hindu mythology. He talks about in the Hebrew scriptures, they're known as the Shadim.
Mm-hmm.
In the Greek New Testament, they're identified as the Daimonia, which is where we get the word demon. Both Shadim and Daimonia refer to entities with volition and consciousness. They're spirits. There is an ancient warning, he says, concerning what happens when the door is opened for the entering of the spirits and the return of the gods. We have ignored that warning, he says. We have opened the door.
Is that the Doors of Guff or something, or the Door of Guff?
I don't know, man. The Door of Guff?
Yeah, it's like, it's weird. It's like, and if that was over opened or whatever, then the spirits, the negative spirits would rain upon the earth. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I've got my scripture wrong, but yeah, it reminds me of something like that.
But it's funny because we don't really dip our toes too much into that world of Christian mythology.
No.
In terms of, you know, spirit possession. We talk about it from, I guess, our view, which is, yeah, there's spirits. We don't necessarily connect them to what's spoken about in the Bible, although it's very much the same thing in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
But he says...
But you're right, because it's not about religion. Like, different religions describe them in different ways. You know, like Islamic is the jinn, for example. You know, we call them demons. The Hindus call them... I can't remember the exact word for it. But regardless, like they're considered to be just a non-human entity. But of course, in these ancient scripts, these ancient books, they're described because they've always been interfering with humanity.
And this is what I like about him. And he says they are by nature possessing spirits. They gained their entrance in the name of tolerance and freedom, but such things were never their goal, only the means by which their goal, dominion, could be achieved. So basically the first quarter of this book is his argument that India is cursed, that India is totally a cursed country. No comment.
Well, I mean, have you been to India?
Let me.
I mean, it's a beautiful country, but
is it that?
Well, I could say okay. Good point. There's like beautiful areas. I've only been to the south.
Haven't you done the Google Maps search?
No, I have, but I have been to the south.
Google Maps challenge.
Like, my guide lived in a shipping container, and there were syringes floating in the river where they also served fish from straight afterwards. And then I saw a guy dumping in the river, and I just went, "Well, lunch is off."
Wait, saw him dumping?
A guy literally like leaning over,
dumping garbage.
No, dumping. Like, had his butt over the edge of the river and was dumping in it. And like, it was like later on because we were further away, and the guy was like, "This is all from here." I'm just like, I'm good. Thanks very much."
I thought that was just on the internet. I didn't think that was real.
No, it's.
It is in many ways, he says, the last great repository of the gods. India, that's where, it's like a time capsule, he says, because in Western civilization, we discarded those things. When paganism went, the gods went. But in India, he says, they were never rejected. And because of its unbroken worship of the gods, Eastern religion serves as a type of time capsule that was once in the West, filled with gods and goddesses, human gods, animal gods, combinations of each, temples, altars, sacrifices. He says Indian religion gives us a glimpse of what once permeated Western civilization and what would come to be known as paganism.
Do you know what, though? What's really taking off in India is Christianity.
Yeah, so that's how he came into this story, because he leads this congregation in New Jersey, and they had a guest speaker one night. This was back in 1998 or 1999, and it was an Indian evangelist named Dr. Job, And he spoke about the connection between India and the Apostle Thomas. So I don't know if you know, but the Apostle Thomas traveled to India.
No, I wasn't.
It said that he was martyred in a city near Chennai. And he spoke about this church tradition, the connection to Thomas and the gospel taken to India. And in the middle of this guy's presentation, he turned to Jonathan Kahn and basically said, you need to go to India. Like, you need to walk in the footsteps of the apostle and you need to go to my country. And so he basically prayed on it. He said, I was to give him an answer before he left. But the problem with that opportunity was that India had just, a new government had come to power,
mm-hmm.
and it was hardcore Hindu nationalists. And there was a lot of violence in the country at the time. Christians were being persecuted. The, Christian schools and cemeteries were being destroyed. Churches were being burnt down.
So this must have been quite a while ago then.
Yeah, 1999.
Oh, right. Okay.
And so he's wondering, should I go? Like, should I actually walk into Mordor?
Well, was he going as a missionary?
Well, yeah, it was this idea to do an official tour, walking in the steps of the apostle and going to the final place where he was martyred.
Yeah, perhaps a time to be more cautious.
Yeah, very sensitive time in the country, but he goes home and he prays about it and he gets the answer, yes, you should go. And so he said the other part of the story was of a much stranger nature, though, in line with the mystery of the Shadim, these spirits of the gods. He said, as soon as I said yes to going to India, an array of strange events began taking place at the congregation. He says, most of which I can't write in these pages, which is unfortunate, but it's
Asuras. I'm sorry, I just looked at when you said the Shadim. So the
Asuras,
Hindu,
yeah.
Asuras. They're Hindu demons.
Yeah, that's right. So every time he organized this trip, every time he put something in place to go on this trip, an obstacle would appear. Something would go wrong.
Right, like the show.
Just like us recording a podcast and losing the entire thing. He said, at the time of the departure drawing nearer, we discovered that our plane tickets had disappeared. The travel agent in charge of obtaining them, we learned, had left the country and left behind no contact number. He said, on the day I was to leave for India, I headed to the airport with no tickets and no assurance I'd be able to board the plane. So that was the first flight out of the United States. Now, he doesn't explain how he got tickets. He sorted it out. He eventually got on a plane. But on the second flight, he said, I'd just taken off from Amsterdam. He was on a flight to New Delhi. And he's sitting there thinking, finally, after all this trouble, I can finally make it to India. And he looks out. He's got a window seat and he looks out at the wing and he just sees parts of the plane flying off.
Oh, my like God.
Bits of the engine flying past the window.
Well, it's definitely a Boeing.
And there's an announcement from the pilot that they have to quickly turn around and head back to the airport. He said the dramatic events did not stop upon reaching India. 2 days after our arrival, my team and I were almost killed, and that was just the beginning. He said I was being led across India in the footsteps of Thomas with multitudes of Indian Christians, often thousands waiting at each site. And ultimately where they were heading was, as I said, this area near Chennai. That's just some Wikipedia photo of the area.
But is he implying, though, that he was like some supernatural force was trying to prevent him from taking that trip?
Yeah, he's very explicit about
it. He is, okay.
Yeah, because he says it's the old gods. The old gods are against the true God.
Mm.
And so because he's doing this for the true God, the true Christian God, he would say, these old forces are doing everything to try and stop him. That's how he views it. And so this area is where the Apostle Thomas, his final destination, he was killed by some Hindu priest on one of the hills in this area. And so that's where he was heading. He says, it wasn't long into our journey that we began noticing strange occurrences of another kind. He said, we were being followed.
By whom?
He said, we would travel over thousands of miles to our destination, but he said he kept seeing the same faces. These serious-looking men were always tailing him. They would always be in the crowd whenever he was at some event. They would always be nearby, everywhere he went. He said it was as if they knew where we were going before we got there, even when our plans had not been made public. He said it appeared as well that they were intensely interested, not merely in observing, but also trying to get close to him. He said they appeared most often to be on edge, tense, and deadly serious. So they took precautions. He knew that this was a risky time in the country, so they took extra security precautions. But then more sort of supernatural things started to happen to him and his entourage. One night they were at a hotel in Tamil Nadu, getting ready to sit down to eat. And he led the team in prayer before they had dinner. And he said, just as he's about to open his mouth in prayer, one of the guys on his security team gets bowled over. Some force hits him in the chest. He goes flying out of his chair.
By nothing, apparently.
Yeah, by nothing. And starts writhing on the ground, foam coming out of his mouth. He has a full-on seizure. They have to call the medical team, the emergency services, come to help him, take him to hospital. They said he had never experienced anything remotely like this that night, nor after leaving India and getting back home to the States. They checked him out. Absolutely nothing wrong with him. Doctors couldn't find anything wrong with him.
No, but the fact that also somehow it appears he was struck by something, it suggests that it's an external factor.
Yeah, they claim they all see it. They saw it, some force knocking him back. That vacuum is driving me fucking insane. Is he just vacuuming like right outside our office? Does he realize there's other areas of carpet in the building? It's like he's just vacuuming outside our door.
We're changing studios, okay? People are sick of us complaining about the fact that it's like a freaking furnace in here constantly.
Oh, my God.
That the air conditioning stuff, the vacuum cleaner is constantly going, garbage stinks.
I know you can't hear it, but just imagine an African guy just vacuuming this like little foot-by-foot piece of carpet. For 20 minutes, he's been fucking doing it.
A batch of the wall.
My God. No one can hear it, though. It's just like in my
ear. I know. I get it. It's all right. It's been a long week, Ben.
So eventually they get to Chennai. And he says the persecution of Hindus on Christians is hitting fever pitch. Upon arriving in Chennai, though, they're visited by one of the city's police chiefs who also happens to be Christian. And they hear that he's sent commandos up the mountain where they're going to make sure it's safe. That's how serious it is, that they're sending in the military to protect these guys. The day arrived for them to ascend up the mountain, and this is where Thomas was martyred and all those years ago. And that same day, he said, another martyrdom took place in India. Another missionary had been killed. An Australian minister and his two sons were brutally murdered by a mob of radical Hindus. And so
you don't hear this commonly about Hindus, though. If you say, like if people are violent, you would never think a Hindu would be violent, but perhaps I'm just sheltered. That's shocking.
That's the story of Graham
Staines.
Just bring
it up on the screen.
Graham Staines and his two young children burnt to death. Burnt to death. Australians burnt to death by Hindu nationalists in 1999. Yeah.
Just disgusting.
Totally forgot about that story.
I never even heard of it.
Yeah. I mean, how much press did it get over here? It was hard to actually find articles today referencing that event that weren't Indian sources. I don't know if our government kind of stomped on the press a little bit.
They probably would have. They would have. Because it's about, you got to think of Australia's relationships with these big, global powers. We're very careful just to shut up about any type of human rights abuses, any types of crime. It's just like, we're piss weak.
So with all this in mind, they still climb the mountain. They get to the top of the mountain. And according to the program, he's meant to go outside and light some flame and then bring it inside the church there and light that.
To
symbolize the something. And as he's preparing to do this, a crowd is gathering and he sees those same guys that have been following him everywhere. And they look like they're ready to kill. And he's really worried this is extremely dangerous. At the last minute, someone who had organized the event says, oh, actually, we're going to change it. I'm going to go out and get the torch and bring it for you so you don't have to go outside. So at this last minute change probably saved him from some kind of horrible confrontation. But while he was on this mountain, he said he ran into an Indian Christian who was actually waiting for him to give him a message. He said a year before, this guy was led to the same mountain to pray. And while praying, the spirit spoke to him of a curse on the land of India, birthed in its rejection of the gospel. The mountain of Thomas embodied that rejection. The spirit, he said, then told him that a Jewish man had come to India and had to ascend to the mountain of Thomas and not get killed. And that would break the curse. So he's like, I'm Jewish. I've just climbed the mountain. I avoided getting killed. I think the curse might be broken. So I think
it's so specific though. there's no way a Jew is ever going to come to this country and climb this mountain, so the curse will never be broken. Like, why?
That's exactly what happened. He said after receiving the word, he traveled through Chennai and Tamil Nadu, proclaiming that the churches and whomever would listen, that a Jewish man had to come to Chennai and ascend the mountain of Thomas. He had no idea, he said, that I was that Jewish man who had come to India to ascend the mountain. So thankfully, we can say on this show now that India is no longer cursed. They were cursed, but are no longer cursed. Yeah, Aaron looks skeptical.
I don't want to say anything because I have some really beautiful Indian friends. So I don't want to, but even they would probably say in some areas that India is still cursed.
I can just picture Bibu listening and he's got like single tear. He's got a single tear running
down. Bibu will be like, you're totally right. You're absolutely right.
But he said there was more than one puzzle piece to the mystery of India and the gods. And it happened at the beginning of the journey that almost brought it to a sudden end. So this is where, remember, they nearly died as soon as they landed in India. So one of the first things they went to was, of course, they had to go to the Taj Mahal. So they're taken to the Taj Mahal, but everyone warns them, don't be in that area after dark.
It's really?
It's way too dangerous. Just you go during the day and then get out of there. But he said traffic was so bad, by the time they arrived there and had a look around, it was already starting to get dark. And by the time they got back to their bus, it was completely dark and a fog had set in. And he said there was something about this fog that was bizarre. It was so thick, you could barely see 20 feet ahead of you. But he said because their bus driver was so anxious about getting them back to the hotel before dark, he was driving like a maniac, like flying through these streets. And Jonathan said, as they're flying, because you would see the fog kind of part, and then there'll just be a truck that's just been destroyed moments later.
So it's almost like the fog is deliberately occluding their vision to cause them to have an accident?
Yeah, and there's
there's an intelligence to
it? A cart that's been turned over, there's like fruit and debris, but this guy just will not slow down. He's flying through this fog. Like, you've seen the videos of people driving.
Yeah, of course I have, right? Yeah.
And they were just terrified. And eventually, of course, their bus driver slammed into the back of a truck. Like, it just came out of the fog and they slammed into the rear of this truck. But the truck driver didn't realize and then kept on driving.
Oh.
And so their bus was swerving and at risk of completely flipping over and maybe killing everyone on board. He said they were lucky. They finally came to a stop. The truck driver realized the bus was like connected to the back of the truck and they managed to get out of there. They managed to get back to their hotel in one piece. But what a crazy first couple of days in the country. Mm. But the reason he mentions this gets to the whole crux of his argument for this book, which, remember, is called The Avatar. He said, after returning home from India, I came across an article on Hindu mythology. It spoke of Krishna. Krishna was an avatar god, the bodily manifestation of the Hindu god Vishnu. He said, according to his myth of origin, Krishna was born or incarnated in a place called Mathura. And Mathura is in Uttar Pradesh, and Uttar Pradesh is the state that contains Agra, the city of the Taj Mahal.
There's also a lot of paranormal phenomena, interestingly enough, through Uttar Pradesh. Like, right. A lot of the reports you hear that from a paranormal standpoint are in that. Is it a province?
Yeah, I guess so. Well, he's mentioning this because they're in the city of Krishna. They're in the area of Krishna. And Krishna is known as the trickster god.
Yes, yeah.
He was famed for performing pranks on the villagers of his land. And according to his myth, the power of Krishna was first displayed when he was a child. It was his first act of warfare. According to the story, a spirit named Sakatasura took on the form of a cart. So this spirit transformed into a cart.
Like the ones they were avoiding as they're driving through the
fog? Yeah. So as a cart, this spirit attempted to crush the baby Krishna who was lying underneath it, but Krishna kicked the cart and overturned it, broke the cart, thus killing his enemy. And you can see this depicted in the painting here where the cart is broken. There's the young Krishna underneath it. Thus, the power of the god Krishna was first manifested in the overturning of a cart. And this is exactly what they saw. They said, now we were traveling the route and land in which Krishna was said to have been born. And it was the night of the overturning of the carts and the four-wheeled vehicles, one after the other. And he says it was our vehicle that barely escaped becoming one of the overturned. What we witnessed that night aligned with what the Bible says of the gods. Behind the gods are spirits, the Shadim, the Demonia, and they were present, active, and dangerous. He said it was our last event in the land that would prove the most dramatic and the scene of a mass phenomenon. So essentially what he's arguing is that these forces manifest, and they're manifesting to stop his particular mission, which is a mission for the church. And the final event that he mentions, they went to this like a series of gatherings, but one of them, word got out, and it was a huge sea of Indian Christians that gathered to hear him speak. 70,000 people he got.
Wow.
70,000 people in this crowd. And he said, as darkness began to fall and the ground started to fill with people, I spoke to the multitude. But he said something else happened at that gathering that would leave those standing with me on stage in awe. He said, I held up a shofar, the ancient biblical trumpet, the ram's horn. He said, I explained that the sound of the trumpet was the sound of freedom and a representation of the power of God, and we would pray for God's power to break any bondage in their lives to bring release and freedom. Again, this is to a crowd of 70,000 people. So he said, I would set the trumpet to my mouth and blow, and he said this ancient sound of freedom would go out to them. Lee said, we couldn't make sense of what happened next. He said, every time he blew the horn, these unearthly screams came back at him, like these hideous shrieks came back at him and everyone on the stage. He said waves of it would come back and back again.
Where from, though? Just out of the ether?
From the crowd.
Oh, like the crowd's possessed.
He said it was waves of blood-curdling screams. The only thing we could liken it to was what one would imagine you might hear in an exorcism. Mm.
Yeah, yes. Like
a demon-possessed person. The screams were coming from the many, he said. It was as if the trumpet blast had triggered a mass deliverance, as if we were witnessing some kind of colossal exorcism.
But aren't they already Christians that had turned out to see him?
Yeah, I guess so.
But they're being exorcised, I suppose.
He's convinced all these people, like imagine exorcising a football stadium. You just get your Jewish horn out. Just like fixed. They're all fixed. That's what he claimed happens. So he points out in the Jewish tradition that the horn is, well, it's used in warfare, obviously, but it also has a correspondence to the spiritual world. So if you blow,
yeah, of course, yeah.
You blow the horn and it scares away the demons.
Was it with Mormons, you know, with the trumpet, right? That's like these instruments, you know, come up in many religions. So like it's specifically a horn.
Mormons have a trumpet?
Yeah.
What does it look like?
It's like on the top of their what, I don't know, is it a church? It's like whatever.
The temple.
The temple, on top of the temple, you've got some guy with a big trumpet.
Is that Gabriel?
I don't know. I'm not that familiar
with Mormons. No, it's the angel Moroni.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, my Mormon friends are just never going to forgive me. Yeah, this guy. Where is he? There he is.
Yeah, there you go.
Moroni.
Yeah.
The guy that gave the book to Joseph Smith.
Right.
He's got more of a bugle, though.
Oh, for God's sake, it's still a horn.
So after this, he goes to Cuba. And there's a great section of the book. Like, he talks about the history of slavery and blacks coming over from Africa. And obviously, they couldn't entirely just bring their religion over and, you know, follow it. There would be maybe persecution. So
is that where, and forgive my ignorance on this one as well, is that where Santeria?
Yeah, this is the origin of Santeria.
Yeah.
So he says they basically kept their old idols but put the masks of saints on the idols.
Right.
So, for example, the mask of Saint Anthony is Elegua, the trickster god of the gates, or the mask of Saint Barbara is the god Chango, the king of the Orishas. And so he talks about how they require sacrifices, and essentially there's this part of this religion, part of following these kinds of gods, where one becomes an avatar. You know, there's dancing, there's altered states of consciousness, sometimes there's drug taking, and someone will channel the god and become an avatar of the god. Now, this is considered something special, something holy. Someone who can do this is a unique, powerful individual. And, you know, we've seen this in many of the stories we've covered over the years
yes.
from religions in Africa and South America.
But is, perhaps it's something different, but is speaking in tongues that dissimilar?
But yeah, I imagine that's the same thing. Mm. It's probably the same mechanism, right? Well, he talks about how the gods seek to possess more than individuals. They seek as well to indwell kingdoms and governments. And he starts talking about Castro's embrace of Marxism, how Cuba became a communist and atheistic state. The Christians and the clergy were persecuted. And Santeria, at the start, was also a religion, was also banned,
suppressed.
But in the end, it continued to be practiced. And the Cuban government increasingly saw Santeria as beneficial in promoting a unified Cuban identity. The government began sponsoring performances of Santerian dances and rites designed to invoke the gods and summon the spirits. Instead of weakening the practice of Santeria, Castro's regime ended up empowering it. In the spiritual realm, the power of Jesus was the antidote to the Santerian spirits and gods, but he says the government's relentless war against the gospel would largely remove that antidote along with its restraining force. So the result was that the Cubans increasingly turned to Santeria to fill that hole that had been, that spiritual hole that had been placed there by atheism and communism.
Well, not just that, though. I think one thing that is becoming quite apparent is that even people that scream that they're atheists, there's a longing for spiritualism. But not, it doesn't have to be organized, but there's like a longing for belief.
Yeah.
And that's filled by sometimes, you know, these government supported concepts. And especially in the West, like we know what that is.
Well, even the most ardent atheist communists still believed in the spiritual side of things. Like there's a famous story about Mao, who, you know, Mao said,
of course,
all religion is poison.
Mm.
But Mao, before one of his
opium for the masses or something.
Yeah. Before one of his revolutionary acts, he consulted like a Taoist priest to get his fortune. You know, like he still believed in the spiritual.
Yeah.
Even though he thought it was poison. He was an atheist.
Well, even Karl Marx was attending seances I was reading the other day.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm like,
well, Marx wrote about the devil and Satan speaking to him and giving him his mission.
Oh, well, that's always positive. That's something you should definitely follow.
But this is a great section of the book because he talks about how Castro, he was born in the cities of spells. He was born in Santiago. The question is, these Santerian gods, one of his arguments is that they're the same gods. Doesn't matter what region they're in. It doesn't matter what religion they're under. It doesn't matter what form they take.
Yep.
They're basically the same set of gods with the same mission.
Yep.
And it doesn't
make sense.
It doesn't even matter what period of time they're in.
Yep.
They're the same. And he says, one of these gods was behind Castro's rise to power. So the one he's specifically talking about is Chango, one of the most powerful and popular gods in that pantheon. In Santerian mythology, Chango was a warrior god. He was celebrated as a symbol of masculinity, virility, but he also had a volatile, temperamental, violent, and murderous temper. And so one of his first comparisons is, well, what was Fidel Castro? He was this strong leader. You know, he was very masculine. He had virility because he had so many lovers, apparently. But he also had this murderous, violent streak. Castro took on the role of a warrior and became known throughout Cuba for his military campaigns and battles. Chango is also known as the seducer god. So he's a charmer. He's a womanizer. He has many lovers. And that's an image of Chango on the screen there. And so, too, it was well known that Castro was a womanizer. He was a seducer. One of his aides said he had up
certain to... certain Canadian women, apparently.
Yeah, yeah, that's a whole other conspiracy. One of his aides said he had 35,000 lovers.
Jeez, that's a lot of work.
He had a team that would go along the beaches of Cuba in the evenings and just round up pretty young girls to take back to Fidel. And obviously, some of them became his concubines and his wives. Chango is also associated with the color red. His worshippers typically dress in red to honor him, as we see on the screen there. So too, Fidel Castro was associated with red. He saturated the island in red. Red flags, red banners, red buildings, the posters, the paintings. You know, obviously this is...
Well, that's a communist
thing, but
yeah.
Red as well. Chango was said to have ruled his kingdom with an iron fist. He was a powerful and violent leader, a tyrant with tyrannical ways. And of course...
He was.
Castro was a dictator. When you have these little, and I don't know if I had any pictures of them.
I don't know what that was.
It's coming up later.
Flashed up, but okay.
He has
going down the hentai path, obviously.
There's these little, you know, like little statues of these Santeria gods.
Sure, yeah.
Right? And you leave offerings for them. Mm-hmm. You leave fruit, you burn incense, you know, the usual stuff. But what do you leave for Chango? Well, Chango likes cigars. You got to leave him cigars.
And what is like the classic image of Castro is a man with cigars.
That's he's always got a cigar
always
in his
had
mouth.
A cigar in his mouth.
To the point where the CIA came up with that plan to make an exploding cigar to assassinate the guy. So I thought that was interesting. Also, the power of destruction, like Chango sends down the bolts from lightning to destroy his enemies. He's in control of like weapons of mass destruction. And of course, Castro.
Well, he worked with you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis, yeah, with the Russians.
Worked with the Soviet Union to bring nukes to the island and brought about that crisis. So Fidel Castro died on November the 25th back in 2016, and his coffin was carried by a military caravan. It went through the lined streets of Santiago to his final resting place. And he came to his final resting place on December the 4th. And what is December the 4th in Cuba? It's the day of Chango.
Right.
And
yeah, there's no coincidences. This stuff is orchestrated by the gods, by the entities. I shouldn't say, because I don't think calling them gods is like really appropriate. It's almost blasphemous when you think of it. Like, they're entities.
Yeah. I mean, well, he uses the little g gods to describe them. But Jonathan Kahn says that in the ancient pagan world, there was this belief that the king who had served as the avatar for one of these gods, when the king died, he would ascend and attain godhood by merging with these entities. And so for Castro to be basically put in the ground on the day of Chango is, again, just underlining this ancient belief, this ancient rite of the avatar of the gods.
But then does the avatar then reincarnate? Or not reincarnate, but perhaps possess someone else? Like,
that's right. So the god will take another form. It will require another avatar. And so what does this have to do with the White Lady? Well, this brings us back to essentially what Kahn is arguing, and he's written other books about this idea that these old gods are coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And this White Lady is one of these old gods.
Yeah, they've tried it in different ways, right? Because I firmly believe that some contactees, even the ones that are clearly looking for attention and fame and perhaps fortune, they did have some form of experience. Something happened to them which was beyond human capability. But I wonder if a lot of it was that these beings, these entities trying to infiltrate humanity, doing it by spreading themselves thin, you know, by basically throwing everything at the wall and seeing what sticks. So they tried the contactee, they've tried to get into political organizations, they've like basically seeded themselves in the root of human misery to be able to infiltrate us and control us.
Well, Kahn makes the argument that they've already been successful, and he writes about the Dark Trinity. And because he's American, his audience is American, he focuses on what he calls the American gods. So the first god he talks about is the Possessor. His name is meant the Master, the Lord, the Possessor, and this is Baal. He was the god who turned a nation away from the god it had once known. Baal caused Israel to forget God, to overturn his ways and precepts, and to drive him out of public life. Baal blurred the lines between the world and God, truth and illusion. So he basically turned them from monotheism to polytheism to pantheism and paganism.
Chaos.
Yeah. So in the early 1960s, he claims there was this critical milestone. The spirit of Baal began penetrating American culture, causing it to drive God out of its national life, out of its schools, out of its public squares, out of its culture, and out of its life. To blur the lines between truth and subjectivity, he moved America from God to the gods and from biblical faith to post-Christian neo-paganism. So that's the first of the Trinity. That's Baal, the Possessor. The second part of this, he claims, was the Enchantress. She was a goddess, a seductress, an enchantress. In Babylon, she was called Ishtar. In the Bible, she was called Ashtoreth, the goddess of sexuality, lust, and prostitution. Indeed, she was worshipped as the great prostitute. So this entity, I believe, is the White Lady that Jake Barber is seeing. that
Bledsloe.
That Bledsloe is seeing, and perhaps what our follower of Otto Rahn, Richard Stanley, is seeing as well. Here's a video of the author of this book, Khan, talking about this ancient goddess. Let's take a listen.
When Israel turned away from God, what happened is this spirit came in that is called the Enchantress, or in the Bible, Ashtoreth, or in Babylon, Ishtar. The spirit of unbridled sexuality. And it's the spirit of a prostitute. She's a prostitute goddess. So in the 1960s, as we turned away from God, America and the West, the same spirit came in. And we witnessed the sexual revolution, and which has not stopped to this day. The return of the prostitute or harlot goddess. In Mesopotamia, the word for prostitute, or one of the words for prostitute, is actually Ishtaru, which it comes from Ishtar, literally. That's how much she was identified with prostitution. She was the patroness, the patron goddess of prostitutes. She was also called Aharemtu, which also means prostitute. In Greece, they used, of course, the Greek language, and so her incarnation was Aphrodite. She's the same goddess. They called her a prostitute too, but the word in Greek for prostitute, listen, is porne, from which we get the word porn and pornography. The word in Greek for writing.
That's a much better name, porne. Porne.
It just sounds so much more sophisticated. I'm buying porne.
It sounds sexier. It does.
I don't know if it's sexier. It sounds French.
Is the word graphos. The word for prostitute is porne. So you have graphos porne or porne graphis. Pornography means the writings of the prostitute. The work, the work of Ishtar. It's no accident. The first pornographic writings on our planet Earth, were the writings about this ancient goddess Ishtar, or Inanna. Pornography comes from her. Even the imagery in ancient Mesopotamia, she multiplied the images of naked women. Their images of her were of her often disrobing. It was pornographic. So it's no accident.
Well, isn't that tablet, which is we were talking about on the book about the British Museum, how you can secretly, not secretly, but you can privately go on and look at that object. And she was like not a goddess. Was she a goddess? A goddess of sex
or
something? Yeah,
it was.
But it carried a curse.
Who's the first?
It was Mesopotamian, but.
I'm trying to remember the name. It's on the right on the tip of my tongue. Right on the tip of my tongue. But you're right. It was this stele in the British Museum, and this strange individual would come in, and it looked exactly like this. It's the woman before Eve.
Lilith.
Lilith, yeah. It was the stele of Lilith, which looks like this, basically. And this guy would come in and just, like, stare at it like a weirdo for hours. He would book a private room to go in with this stele and just, like... I don't know. Hopefully there's windows.
We've both been to Japan, so like we can assume what's going on.
This poor guy had to go in with a bucket and mop afterwards and clean it up. But isn't that intriguing? And predictably, this book from Jonathan Kahn just goes into hilarity after this because...
Why do you say that?
Well, if you read ahead, because it's about American politics, pretty soon he's saying that Kamala Harris is like one of these gods reincarnated. And Joe Biden is like some sleepy demon, and God's like some Trump's like some ancient warrior that's sent to, return, blow the trumpet. It's like predictable. It's predictable, like boomer Christian slop.
Okay.
But I thought, he's writing to an audience. Like, this guy pumps these books out, and it's kind of corny, and it's like a Dan Brown style conspiracy.
Oh, it's definitely got, an audience to it.
But there is something to this idea that the old gods have returned, because we are seeing this. And this really, you could say a large part of this force would describe our show from the last 20 years.
Oh, easily.
Like, we've been talking about this stuff for decades. Yeah. And it seems as though that current is always consistent. No matter what topic you talk about in the paranormal world, this current is always there.
Well, it really comes down to, if you make it very reductive and just so simplified, it comes down to human interacting with a non-human, the non-human always acting in the in deception, always in deception, and then leading the human down the dark path. that ultimately ends up in something not good happening for the human.
Well, one example, remember we made fun of this occult guy because he would always go on this video interview and talk about how the genders needed to be blended.
Oh, that was the
guy who...
androgyny guy.
The key to enlightening on the path of gnosis was androgyny.
Androgyny. Yeah, but he was clearly like some type of pervert that was like...
He was just an old queer.
He was just some old queer that had like this weird obsession with turning like a Kinsey, like turning everyone into something that was just unusual.
And that's why I had the image of the Transformer, because he's got he's got a chapter on the Transformer. And he says, in her ancient inscriptions, the goddess announces, I am a woman, I am a man. The hymns of the goddess praise her for turning a man into a woman and a woman into a man. She was the transformer. She blurred the lines between male and female, altered sexuality and gender, emasculated men and defeminized women. And so, yeah, obviously the argument is that that whole thing comes from one of these old gods. And among the signs with which she was associated was that of the rainbow. And in one month of the year, she especially possessed the culture. This was the month known as Junium.
Wait, so one month of the year, she's possessing the culture and controlling the rainbow.
And the month was Junium, which corresponds to June.
Is that Pride Month?
Yes, it's Pride Month.
You can't make this stuff
now,
up.
Now, I don't know how much if of that is true. Like, I don't know how much Jonathan can kind of... Because he doesn't give references for this part specifically.
Right, of course he doesn't.
He does for other sections. For this, it's just like, okay, I'll take your word for it, bro. But I find that kind of interesting. But I wanted to finish on a mention of a book I've covered before called The Devil in Dreamland. It's by Ursula Bielski.
Oh, great book. Yeah.
You remember this one? Well, she came across the story of Bledsoe as well, and she first heard it in 2023, and it was around the time that we covered it. She said in 2007, a series of events unfolded during a fishing trip that forever changed Bledsoe's life. And if you don't know the story, basically, he was on a fishing trip with his son and a few of his son's friends. And he started to see these giant glowing orbs. Again, these orbs, right?
So it's got a UFO feel to it.
And Bledsoe's companions told him he had been absent throughout the night and they'd spent the night searching for him. So he has missing time. He kind of gets frozen in place by one of these orbs. He's not sure what happened to him. His son went missing. When he found his son, Bledsoe found him with two translucent beings who were 3.5 feet tall with red glowing eyes. Chris Jr., Bledsoe's son, said he'd been frozen for hours. He was only released when his dad arrived on the scene. Now, later, a Harvard-trained physicist would come to the Bledsoe house to hypnotically regress Chris. During the session, Bledsoe said he was able to touch one of the lights during this period of missing time, and he was taken into a room and surrounded by entities. This is what he recalled. He panicked and asked where his son was, and the beings told him his son was being kept safe. They told Chris they were from the Creator, and they were there to protect humans from dark forces. The beings flew Chris to Egypt, telling him that the Sphinx gazing at regular just before sunrise would mark the beginning of a new age, and this would happen in August of 2026. That's where he got the date.
And that's the other thing that is always included, going all the way back through contactees and these people that have these experiences, they're always given a date.
Mm.
Have you noticed?
Mm.
There's always a date, and what happens every single time?
Nothing. One night, Bledsoe woke up from his sleep, greeted by an ethereal voice reverberating through the room, urging him to rise. He was compelled to slip on his shoes and he went walking out into the fields. And there he was greeted by luminous beings composed entirely of pure light. Chris followed their lead and he arrived at a spot. And this is where he first meets the White Lady. She was a resplendent female figure, flowing blonde locks, piercing blue eyes, and a shimmering gown floated above the ground. And she was radiating. She was radiating this glowing light.
Kind of like what happened to Richard.
This is exactly what Richard Stanley described when he was trying to trace the steps of Otto Rahn. Now, Chris's mind immediately turns to angels because he's been raised a Christian. Then, to his amazement, the being introduces herself as the mother goddess of the universe, the embodiment of the divine feminine spirit, universal love, and the Holy Spirit of the sacred trinity of the Christian God.
See, actually, that's something that we've kind of skipped over, but is an important point, because we've often called upon these experiences and said that, well, look, the entity just basically is tapping into your mind and forming whatever it has to from what it pulls from your mind, the information it has. So if you've got someone who's coming from a Christian upbringing,
right,
and they're encountering this thing, what it's doing, it immediately locks onto that and presents itself in that fashion.
That's how it appears. And of course, Richard Stanley, he's
correct,
completely filled his mind with this medieval version of yes, the past, this medieval battle. And what? How does the lady appear to him as this medieval goddess? Yeah. Now, Bledsoe said he was surprised to discover that many government agents, because he eventually reached out to the police and the FBI, many government agents, including some from NASA, already knew about the lady. He shared that it was NASA operatives who told him that the being had also appeared to many others, but had given the names of various ancient goddesses like Isis. They further suggested that the Christian church had likely long ago forced this spirit into their Jesus-centered myth as Mary. Bledsoe's son Ryan told podcaster Danny Jones that ufology legend and NASA researcher Tim Taylor, who I think eventually his true identity was revealed, we've mentioned it on the show, he would meditate every morning, and Taylor told his dad to get into Kundalini yoga to assist with the spiritual awakening.
Oh, no.
Later, the lady would identify herself to Bledsoe by the name of Hathor, an Egyptian sky goddess.
That's right.
Known to hang around with a bull, which was interesting because initially, remember, he was having visions of a bull before he actually saw the lady and was confused by that. But there's a great post I'll link to in the show notes. It's from a Catholic scholar. Why has it disappeared? There it is. Catholic 460. Professor Matthew Sakanakis, Rosicrucian Principles Infiltrating Christianity. He was one of the first researchers publicly to make this connection between what Bledsoe was experiencing and the Egyptian goddess Aset. The Greeks called her Isis, and she was the demonic imposter, queen of heaven of the ancient world. Exactly what Christopher Hahn was describing as this seducer goddess, the one that would twist the morality of Americans. In Bledsoe's reports, in fact, Sakanakis had identified a string of references to Isis and the Rosicrucianism she is so closely associated with. He realized the connections of Bledsoe's experiences to Rosicrucianism after Diana Pasulka commented on in 2004, this was on the Joe Rogan show, she mentioned that Jacques Vallée, John Mack, and other prominent ufologists are Rosicrucians.
Hmm.
They're all Rosicrucians. According to Bledsoe, his encounters with the mysterious entity have been ongoing for years. The lady is said to possess advanced knowledge and wisdom that surpasses human understanding. The lady communicates with him telepathically, directly into his mind in perfect English. The teachings emphasize the importance of love, compassion, and realizing one's own divine potential, using the whole New Age Christ consciousness gospel that you hear.
You know, I don't want to use this analogy again, but I really do have to. And I know it wasn't in the Mothman Prophecies in like the book written by John Keel, but in the film, the dramatization of it, the film with Richard Gere, you know, there was this John Keel character, and he basically is talking to Richard Gere, and he's saying, you know, along the lines of, well, these entities, they don't actually have foresight and they don't have more knowledge than what we do. But if you look up on that building up over there, whoever is standing up in that building, and obviously I'm paraphrasing, but whoever's standing up in that building, they are able to see much further into the distance than what we can from down here.
I see, yeah.
And what's being described right there is like, and what happens is these people, they interact with these entities and they're filled with wisdom and knowledge, and you know, and it's, which is so impressive to us as a human being. But you very quickly realize it's simply because they can just see beyond the spiritual horizon, further than we can. They're not full of wisdom at all. They've just got a better perspective.
And remember when we were talking about Richard Stanley and his white lady,
mm-hmm.
we were kind of criticizing towards the end of the book. It seemed as though his ideology just had a lot of the usual trappings of, you know, just like liberal, democratic, modern slop.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just like fighting racism and like feminine power and just.
Oh, all virtue signals.
Just the usual slop.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that he professes, this is Bledsoe, he professes that her appearances to him are heralding the coming new age of the divine feminine. This promises to be an age of what some term feminine movements such as climate rescue, oh, racial justice, reproductive health care, and female political power. And of course...
Oh, Margaret Thatcher?
Of course.
Oh, not that female political party.
Of course, there's a new kind of Christianity coming that is going to replace what has been corrupted by the evil church. Like the evil current version is corrupted and it needs to be replaced by the new feminine version. So I think it's pretty obvious what we're dealing with here, because that is what the White Lady was from Richard Stanley. It was this idea of this new Gnostic Rosicrucian return of the old pagan ways, out with the old, in with the new, girl power, like feminist religion, right? This was what was coming.
See, but the problem,
all given by this glowing white lady.
People will, you know, like bandy about these terms like, oh, you're racist or you're sexist, you're a climate denier, all this crap, right? Which they have no understanding of what it really is. The thing is, it's actually like, it's not about women, sexes, races, anything like that. It's none of that. Like, it's not about that. What it's about is this corrupting force that is coming through and latching onto whatever it can to look at, go, well, look, there is like an injustice in the sexes sometimes, and there is an injustice between races sometimes. And what it does, it takes these things and exploits them, ramps them all the way up. So what does it do? It creates chaos in humanity.
And hatred and everything
hatred
else.
And division. And ultimately, what does it come down to? Divide and conquer. Because that's what this force wants to do. This force has nothing good for humanity. It's all about destruction.
And remember, Chris Bledsoe and his entire family were Christians. And I say were because they've now, like, Bledsoe left the church. And his son, Ryan, has been on a bunch of podcasts. He's got a podcast himself. He said they don't need to worry about these negative entities when they've been exploring these things, because he quotes the Bible and says we have dominion over them. We have dominion over these lower entities. But he also says his dad and his experiences have led him into a whole world of occult interests.
Oh, no.
First, he started seeing these light beings. Then, quote, this is what he said, "Next thing you know, I'm studying Hermeticism and Gnosticism and Rosicrucianism and wisdom traditions and things like that. It's all part," he says, "of a great awakening that's happening." And the author of this book, Ursula Bielski, says, well, it's an awakening that's going to show us that God is essentially too big for religion to understand, but apparently comprehensible through occult tools and occult traditions. That's the irony of it. It's like...
But that's the path to these beings accessing us.
It's like religion is broken and corrupted. This is what they say. It's all broken and corrupted. But if I get the right codex... This is what I was saying on the last show the show that we lost. Mm. If I find the hidden manuscript... then I'll be able to understand it. Then I'll have the true gnosis. All I need is the right decoding of numerology figure it out.
What it comes back to, though, as well, it comes back to this deep needing to know. That's what it is. Like, and people can cast aside religion, spirituality, whatever else, become completely atheist. There's this still deep longing to know.
Well, it really goes back to the whole apple and the tree thing, isn't it?
It does. Yeah, absolutely it does.
It's this irresistible... Yep. Temptation.
But it is irresistible. I remember years ago, we attended this really great presentation, and it's so far back, I can't recall who it was, but it was about Gnosticism, and I was really taken
by
it.
That was Graham Hancock.
Oh, was it Graham Hancock?
Yeah, who's weaving his spell.
Maybe it's just simply because it's Graham Hancock, but I was really taken by it. But afterwards, I started reading it, and I was like, oh, whoa, like, what am I doing? Okay, so because it really does have this appeal, but the closer you look to it, and you start realizing that this is actually not what I thought it was, it's like, but that's why people get sucked in by it. It's like this allure of this knowledge. But what that knowledge is, no one really knows. That's the whole point. It's like, what am I yearning for to know?
Power.
Does it grant power? Is that what it is?
Well, knowledge is power, right?
That's true. Yeah.
And the system teaches that, well, you can become a god through power, through knowledge of power.
Yeah, but we're not meant to be. This is the whole thing I don't get either, though. We're not meant to become gods.
Well, I think that's what I was saying to you. That's what I was saying to you on the show that we lost, is the traditional upright Orthodox religions.
Oh, they're long gone.
Talk about loving your enemies.
Yes. Yes, they do.
Turning the other cheek.
Yep.
They talk about upright, righteous, moral things. They don't talk about gaining the secret codex to unlock the knowledge to become a god.
But also destroying things so that you can gain that knowledge.
Right. It's you gain knowledge through faith. It's like faith that gives you knowledge and wisdom. But it's kind of, Gnosticism is a little bit backwards.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's just my understanding of it. I don't trust this whole return of the lady, the white goddess. I don't trust these UFO guys with bug eyes talking about how the lady overcame them and they broke down crying. Yeah. I don't trust this.
It's actually all very, you know what it is as well? It's all very primal emotions, which suggests to me that that's not divine.
And isn't it amazing that it's firmly in our wheelhouse permanently?
Permanently.
Because so many of these guys see UFOs. They summon UFOs.
Yeah.
They want to summon them for their technology. And this white, like you said earlier, this white lady goddess takes on whatever form you're expecting. So if you have these teams of guys going out there with their gay psionics and summoning down UFOs, that's exactly what they're expecting. That's what this entity is going to serve up to them.
I don't know why this is so terrible. The moment you said that, I just get this image of some guy just running out with like, you know, a party popper full of glitter and just pointing it at the sky. UFO straight down. Done. But if that's true, how come there's no UFOs over Mardi Gras? Just saying.
Great point.
There you go.
I hadn't thought of that.
There you go.
That's a wrap. I'll link to all that stuff in the show notes. I guess the big takeaway is that India is cursed.
Not anymore.
Well, because I don't think it worked. I think that something went wrong. Like something obviously went wrong in that ceremony. The curse wasn't broken. In fact, the curse got worse.
The curse doubled down.
I'll link to Richard Stanley's Grail Hunter again in the show notes.
Can we move on from that book now?
Yeah,
can we move on? Great book. Pick it up, read it, but let's move on.
And check out Jonathan Kahn, The Avatar, if you want to learn how Kamala Harris is actually the reincarnation of an ancient prostitute god. It's pretty funny. That's a wrap for this show. Thank you so much for listening. Make sure you check out mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. where you'll find access to our membership. Sign up today. You get access to the big extensions we do on these shows every single Friday. And of course, you get an exclusive show every single Tuesday as well. We've got multiple tiers. If you sign up for MU Max, you get access to our entire back catalog, going back nearly 20 years worth of podcasts. And a lot more coming up on this episode. We're going to be going into some of those strange encounters that Aaron mentioned at the start of the show. Chin guy.
No, we skipped over him because we covered him on another Plus episode. But he's in there.
Weird. Look at the bulge on this guy.
Gay psionics.
It's like 1950s gay psionic in the tree. There's in the tree for some reason.
Yeah, it's environmentalism in the 1950s.
Has he got wings?
He does have wings. Well, it's like a caped wings.
Okay. And Sonic. Where's Sonic?
Oh, we've already covered Sonic as well. You're not selling it.
I want to talk about him again.
Oh, okay, I actually do have more details about Sonic.
Mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Sign up today. That's a wrap for this free edition of the show. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week.